Hey, Whitey. How are we all? Welcome to another episode of the Edgy Futurist podcast. We are super pleased to be back on for another episode. Steve, it is good to see you again, my friend, with a nicely trimmed beard, like you said, and wearing the merch. For those people who are just listening, Steve's got his Edgy Futurist Uprising 2023 jumper on. He's kissing the badge like he's playing for Leeds. Just before we get into having a little bit of where things are, we announced very recently about the Edgy Futurist Uprising 2024, which is on the 11th of July. 11th of July 2024, and we are looking forward to getting people together up in Leeds at the Old Red Bus Station. We've got some awards, we've got some cool stuff going on as well. So yeah, massive piece of news in our space, and we're looking forward to that event. Steve, how are you, bud?
I'm good, really good. Can say good a little bit more. As if I've never been on a podcast before. Why do I feel so nervous? I don't know, Ben. Put me under pressure. But I'm great, fans. You know what? I'm tired. My little boy's back to not sleeping again. So having to spend most of the night upright with him sleeping here is always a challenge. But I'm back running. I'm continuing to do that. I did my 10 mile and I'm now in half marathon stage and just building. So physically, my body feels a little bit broken, but I'm energized. I'm good to go. And life's good, man. It'd be better if it wasn't raining. Just slightly warmer, but a little bit, but raining. But I'm good. How about you? What's life? How's the world of
life is very, very good. Kids are just 13 and 9. Like, it's just life ticks along. Life's full, loads of stuff on, but everybody's happy and healthy. And I went to see Stephen Bartlett's. Anybody who knows me knows that I am a massive Stephen Bartlett fan. I buy everything that comes out, listen to his podcast like minutes after it's released. So I went to see his Business and Life speaking tour recently, and it just kind of blew my mind. Loads of stuff in it. If you follow me on socials, the handle's on the screen there for anybody who's interested who doesn't follow me already. I'll be talking loads and unpacking it. But there's one thing I think really just hit me like it's train last time in this conversation, and it was about you put on screen, this is your age, this is how many days you've lived, and then based on the average life expectancy, how many days you've got left, right? And it blew my mind that I was past halfway probably on life expectancy, but also made me start thinking about all sorts in terms of my kids, my parents, all the stuff that goes within it. Just brought a lot of stuff back into perspective that made me realize, do you know what? We've got to do some things and make some things count. Save a little bit, but also live life to the full, right?
Sounds unbelievable. Don't want to dampen that. Sounds like the best thing to ever attend. Thanks for the invite, mate. Really appreciate going along. Oh no, I didn't get an invite. It was good. I have seen him at the he keynoted at the BET Awards, this year, the year before. So he's an inspiration of ours, isn't he? The way that he carries himself and the way that he interviews and leads his guests through the podcast. But sounds great, mate. And that literally does link in to a lot of different things. One, our guests, but also for anybody who doesn't know my obsession with country music, just before this came on, I was listening to Luke Combs. And anybody who is a Luke Combs fan, Hurricane. So think about Hurricane, like hit me like a southbound train, hit me like a hurricane. He's literally just, as you were talking through those words, I'm thinking, Ben's, he's almost singing a Luke Combs song.
I'm just not going to sing. I won't put the listeners through that. Yeah,
Ben, that night in karaoke at BET, I remember me and you. You are a good singer. we said 3 minutes and we're 4 minutes now. I guess I can see you're just about to push the button and leave, so we better bring her in.
Yeah, it's lovely to. Sorry, we've been chatting, but it's lovely to have Petra with us today, and she's going to be telling us a little bit about her life, her story, and then obviously we did a bit of an intro before we went live and explained that Edgy Futurist is literally what it says on the tin. We want to talk about the future of education, and I know that our listeners today, those people who are watching or are listening, will take loads from this conversation. So, Petra, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thanks for having me. That was the most entertaining 4 minutes of my life, so I appreciate being behind the scenes listening in.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, this is what we do. We are a service to the world. So we try our best. Yeah. So, well, we heard about you from a good friend of the podcast, Ed Kirwan. Many of you who are listening will know that Ed runs Empathy Week, and he said you need to speak to Petra. Her story is powerful, and what she's trying to do in her world will be really relevant to our listeners. So, Petra, I wonder if you just give us a little bit of an overview of you and your story.
Sure. Thanks for having me. I mean, Empathy Week launch we did at Snapchat was pretty intense because the theme was home. And I was kind of up there being asked questions about the concept of home. And it's, you know how sometimes we get asked to talk on something and it's like just happening in our lives right then, like change or whatever. I was like, Ed, I don't know if I can do this. But it kind of brought the magic, I guess, of something being really real. And so I'm a mental health consultant, psychotherapist. I run a business that helps organizations think about their culture and think about how to help people thrive rather than just what to do when somebody's struggling. And it sort of spans, you know, I'm passionate. Many of us in this space are passionate because we're a little messed up and we've been on a journey ourselves of in learning to invest in our own mental health. And so I was born and raised in a religious cult. And so people immediately jump to conclusions because, like, I watched that one documentary, you know, and then they put their story onto me of what they think that was like. It wasn't like that. There were some good bits, like, think, you know, growing up in communes. I'm Dutch by passport, but grew up in India and Brazil and Russia and Kenya and sort of all over the place. Very purpose-led. There was clear mission, you know, so all these kind of things that can actually support or boost mental health and well-being. But over time, of course, when you're born into something, it's just your normal, no matter how toxic it is. It's just like, this is the way it goes, right? And so it was as a teenager that I began to kind of think, oh, not everyone's life is like this, right? And so we thought the world was going to end every 2 or 3 years. So there was that kind of shortness of time. Talk about your Stephen Bartlett thing. You're halfway through. It was like, your life is about to end, like, all the time, right? And I didn't go to school as a kid. So I'm really excited about this conversation about education and the future of it. Because I thought everyone else was getting the most perfect, wonderful, supportive education that was like a blueprint for their lives. And that when they became adults, they were ready or they knew what the hell was going on. Right. And that I was the one that had a bit of a deficit there. So I guess my story spans once I left the cult, that's when I guess I spiraled and had to figure a couple of things out. But thankfully, I figured a few things out and was able to kind of build up my own career and support my own kids as they went through the education system as well.
Fascinating about, like, a story of not having education, but then I know before we went on air, you said about how you thought that education was the most important thing, right? Because obviously you hadn't had it and you'd had that perception that it was going to be the panacea, the thing that's going to change everybody's life. Everybody had a better option, right?
And I stand by it, but just not the institution. So I think learning is the key to life, right? But we can learn in so many different ways. And of course, if we think of certain groups and women and stuff, I still think uneducation, a formal education of some sort, is invaluable to set you up if it teaches you to critically assess and weigh up information so that you can challenge groupthink and learn to think for yourself. Like that's the missing link, or one of the missing links, I should say, because I bet there's a whole list as far as I see it.
I sat on an employer panel at a college in the north of England, and one of the questions was around AI, and it was an AI conference. And I said, I remember giving a presentation 8 years ago and talked about human intelligence versus artificial intelligence and all of those complexities of actually, we still need to come, nothing's changed. AI will really completely change the game in terms of education and the world if we allow it to happen. But also, it hasn't changed the need for what learning should really be about, what education really should be about. And I said, the challenge, and there was about 400 teachers and educators in the room and their leaders, and I just said, the challenge that I give to you for my children is stop teaching compliance. Stop. And I don't think it's a teacher's fault. I said, we're building young people that have a fear of failure because they're told that when they get to 16 or SATs or whatever stage they go through, they don't get this, they're a failure. And also we're teaching these young people to be compliant, that curiosity killed the cat and all these different things. And I'm like, I want my, as much as I always talk about it often, and I love my children, by the way, but my kids are feral, but I love it because they don't want to listen to me. They're independent. They do as they want with some restrictions, but ultimately they are independent thinkers. And I want my boy and my girl to be like that, because ultimately I'd hate to think that they're just doing something because I've told them to do it. And our education system has created compliance at every level, which is really what education isn't about. It's completely the reverse of it, in my opinion. So I really, really, really side with that. Don't know where I'm going. I waffle often. What's my name again? What's my age again? But yeah, I think that really resonated with me. And I think what you've just said is in regards to another thing with Stephen Bartlett, and I posted onto social media the other day. And let me just try and find it. Sorry, I should have prepared this. But it's that whole thing of when you're not in it, it's that kind of FOMO bit of you think that you've missed out on something exceptional, or you see other people and how they're living. And I think mental health, me and Ben have both been open about some of our mental health struggles and challenges. And this really resonated with me. No one knows what they're doing. Not even the ones with degrees, not even the ones with big jobs, titles, or the people on your vision boards. Everyone is just trying loudly, failing loudly, and trying again. So should you. And I think that's that thing of when you're not in it, you always look at the next step, the person who's paid slightly better than you, the person with the next job, the person who is getting education or a different living to or a different world to what you were in, Petra, when you were living through that. You're always aspiring to be something else.
We think it means life is easier when we compare our insides to other people's outsides, right? Oh, they had it easier. They had the rules. They had the playbook, whatever it might be, right? What actually, and because I've coached and sort of done therapy with very senior execs, right? And they're saying the same human things like imposter syndrome or what the hell am I doing or my relationships suck or, you know, and I'm like, oh, it's me seeing that, having the privilege of seeing inside people's minds that have all of those, you know, went all in the right direction and yet they're depressed or anxious. And then Steve, I wanted to pick up on that word compliance, but as it relates to the mental health and well-being space. And I think we're in this age of mental health well-being influencers, right? The three-step formula to handle your brain or to manage anxiety or to do this thing or do that thing. And it's like added into this information overwhelm of I'm not doing it right. If I haven't done the eight-step framework and then this guy said something different and that, you know, so I really challenge us to experiment with what works for us and to learn to listen to our bodies, to learn to reflect, to actually decide what is a good investment for your mental health at that phase of your life, because it may very well evolve. But I think the same problems are showing up in the mental health space at the moment.
And I couldn't agree with both of you more, right? It's that space around compliance or control or like that expectation. There is everywhere you go, you're moving in those areas about like what you're going to show, what you're not going to show, what can you let out. And Bartlett taught yesterday about one of his podcast episodes was about everybody has three lives. You have your public life that everybody sees. You have your private life that only a couple of people see. And then you have your secret life. And like which like it was a spy trying to get into people's secret lives. And that was his guest. And that conversation of where we and how you can be your authentic self and all some of that stuff I know can be really trite. And I know that organizations trying to say, oh, bring your authentic self into this space. And we all want everybody to be their authentic self. And sometimes that is just an excuse for people to not really care about other people and just, this is me. You get over it. Like, this is what you're going to expect. And sometimes you've got to do the work. I understand that. And actually, interestingly, my own personal, not just journey with mental health, which obviously I've always been very open about on the podcast and beyond, and my own journey around that, and still a continuing journey in that space. It was really interesting being a late diagnosed ADHDer. And so when I was neurodivergent, and I'd known forever, right? And everybody around me had always known. But having that kind of safety of, do you know what, there's an identity thing there that's kind of, it's not a validation, although it might be, but there's that thing around, and I think it ties into that compliance and control that I've always felt I have to not be my, well, if people really knew me and if they really saw the real Ben, like they wouldn't want to be around that. And interestingly, my wife said to me when I was going through this process of diagnosis, and she said, what are you hoping to achieve from it? Like, why are you going through this? And I was like, interesting. I'm not really sure why. She also said, it doesn't change how the people around you actually care about you, either way, whatever it is. So like, we don't change. And she went, I really hope that you don't feel like you need to change. And she talked about this thing around, if you go on medication, or if you go through, is it going to change the way you are? And we had a lot of conversation with the clinician in that space. But what I really loved in that space, and you probably take it for, I've took it for granted, being with my wife for 20 years, like that whole space of, there are people that you can bring your real self into, like your personal, your public, your private, your secret life, and kind of be in that space. And even with all those divergences, even with all those hang-ups and struggles and experiences, we're just all trying to get along, right? We're all trying to do the best for our kids. We're all just trying to stay sane and help other people. And yeah, so there's a lot in it, right?
So much, so much. So bringing your whole self to work, I think it's bringing your adult self to work. That means your ability to emotionally regulate, in theory, your responsibility to communicate your needs and who you are in a way that is appropriate for that environment, but it can be authentic. So it is like real. And of course, with my team and my business, we're on the extreme end of, you know, oh, I got triggered because my PTSD acted up, or, you know, oh, my anxiety this, or I can't, my kids are driving me crazy, or I'm going through a fight with my boyfriend, you know, like things like real life stuff. We do bring it into the workplace. Of course, we're a small team, and so we've nurtured that safety for some time. But I think people get mixed up with bringing your whole self to work means just being an idiot and yelling at people or doing whatever you want, you know, but it's like we need integrity and profession, you know, and a professional hat that allows us to communicate in a particular way. But that doesn't mean we can't show emotion or be upset or have something real happen. And the neurodivergence thing is huge, right? Because I think that's been your path, but I would also relate to it as labels in general. So like, I have an anxiety disorder, or I have, you know, like having that label. Everyone relates to a label differently, right? For some people, they're like, oh my God, finally, like my experience is validated and I have this thing I can look into now and then I can manage it, medication or not, right? For other people, it's like, I am now this thing, right? And it puts them in a box. So it's that nuance of allowing people that difference and that in communication, that can be a beautiful thing to say, hey, I experienced this label this way. That doesn't make the other person wrong, right? That's, to me, is what inclusion is. It's not just going, all neurodivergent people need to say their label and be open about it. You might not want to, right? So it's just humans are different, but so the same as well. It's hilarious when I have like one session with somebody and I just kind of pattern, connect dots, and they're like, oh, you know, and I'm like, humans are pretty similar when you actually do it for a couple of years, you know, it's interesting.
Oh, I'm conscious of what I say here. I can't bring my whole self.
Steve, I've already got you figured out. That was pre-call.
Yeah, I know you did. Yeah, that's my concern. Oh, I know. Why is she reading my mind, everybody? Why is she reading my mind? I don't know what to say. I'm nervous. Well, that's a challenge. That's a challenge. She knows me, Ben. Why is she putting that pressure on me?
Overthinking you, Steve. Never.
I can see it in your eyes.
So that's why I wear glasses. I need to start wearing the poker glasses on a regular basis then. So just you touched upon that you're working in a small team. Obviously, you've talked a little bit about your journey, but maybe just touch upon that current work. And then obviously, you shared a bit of your background. And what led you to that point? Because we've not really touched upon the steps that you took. I know you said where you'd come from a little bit, and then and some of the stuff that you've done. But it'd be nice to kind of, as short as we can, go through that journey and where you're currently at. Not to finish the podcast on 25 minutes, but let's get that bit nailed first, and then sure, step into it.
So when I was 20-21, well 18-21, I was firmly leading a double life. So on the one hand, I was actually trusted as a leader in the communities, and I spoke that language and could wear that mask. And on the other hand, was leading that secret life, Ben, to use that language, of like, you know, drink, drugs, you know, hedonistic lifestyle, escapism, just couldn't make sense of life, right? I then was dating somebody who was outside of the community, which you weren't supposed to do. So that secret life kind of was escalating, and then fell pregnant with my son, who's now 20. But that meant that at 22, I moved to London, and that was kind of my break from the cult. Like, so I was like, okay, let me give my son a chance. His father was obviously the guy I was dating and became my husband for a little while. And that was kind of the switch. But what people don't think, and what my expectation was, is like, it wasn't just now I'm free of escape. The question I get all the time is, how did you escape? And, you know, I often compare it to the Shawshank Redemption movie, where there's the escape scene, tension, background music, you know, rain.
What poster did you have on the wall?
Exactly. There's the spoon digging, like the whole thing, right? And there's that beautiful scene at the end where he's like crawled through like tunnels and tunnels of shit, and the rain's coming, and you're like, he's now free. But you're also like, fucking run, man. You're not completely out of the situation, right? But anyway, because everyone's seen that movie, and then you kind of go, well, it's not like that, because you don't have a firm beginning, middle, and end where you're now free, because there's no walls. Like, the walls are in your head, right? It's the thinking. It's like, I'm a bad person if I do this thing. Like, it's ingrained into your own brain. So you don't even need anyone around you for that to kind of kick off. And so short version is, the next 8 years or so, I ended up having my daughter as well, spiraled into alcohol addiction, depression, suicidal ideation, put myself at risk, put my kids at risk, you know, just like, you know, a list of, I guess, trauma symptoms coming out that I didn't really have explanation for. Like, I couldn't really make sense of it. I then started my education journey, which I would say was, you know, an absolute lifesaver for me, because it was that pathway in that moment, metaphorically and practically, to investing in myself and giving myself a chance at a different life, and my kids a chance at a different life. So with a few rock bottom moments, I ended up getting sober and beginning experimenting with, okay, well, everyone says these things help your mental health. Like, which ones are going to work for me? And over time, training as a psychotherapist and then working in youth mental health with kids who'd been kicked out of school or were young offenders, for somehow I related to the outcasts, the kids that maybe didn't fit into the system, and then moved into employee well-being. Thinking again, like, you know, the mecca of learning and growth and skill. And whoa, I now speak on stage as a keynote speaker about how cults are like corporates, right? And the exact similarities that I see on both sides, as far as hierarchies, power, greed, struggle, groupthink, not having a voice, good people staying quiet, people sitting there burnt out and dying, you know, physically and mentally, but going, but I just need my paycheck. Like, this is what's going to help me survive. The whole thing is back to front and messed up. And so the reason I started my business, to come full circle, is I got sick of working for mental health companies, employee well-being companies that told other people what to do, but didn't do it themselves. And I was like watching the toxicity in the space while we were meant to be the wise people helping others. And so I basically started my business to prove a point and to just think, is it possible to be a profitable business that needs to survive and supports people and actually do the things yourself? So we're a little bit extreme in all the things that we do, but because we're case study one, we're ground zero for kind of how we then work with other companies.
Okay. So I love this, the similarities between cults and corporations in an education setting. Very interesting as well. Yep. So I just to kind of flip back before I go into that education setting, I work with another public sector organization, which I won't name because just for the sake of confidentiality, but that organization was extremely hierarchical. And it was the deference and or the fake deference to the people in power and the people with certain letters in front of or after the name and the way that people treat work differently when that person was sat at the table versus how they were when that wasn't the case. And like the ability for like you ask people are asking questions, but they did it anonymously so that they weren't really asking the question just in case, all them things. And although speaking at that conference and being involved in those panels was really rewarding, it also reminded me that in society we've created and we perpetuate not just the compliance and the expectation stuff that we were talking about earlier, but the identity roles and then the politics that go with that and then the economics that kind of line alongside that, and therefore that then keeps people in their own position and makes them realize that this is my level. To get to the next level, I've got to either think about how I work with others. So every conversation then becomes a transactional thing. Everything becomes about how do I utilize that relationship to be able to get where I need to get to. And it's absolutely happening in education. So you see that kind of hierarchy. I've been quite open about this, that both my daughters are in good schools where they are, the mainstream non-fee paying schools, but they're good at what they do. One daughter is in a quite free, happy space. She's in primary. The eldest has gone to secondary, and it's all about the length of the skirt, the color of their earrings, the amount of makeup they do or don't wear, the where they walk, what they carry, what color pen they write in, how many words you're allowed to say. Like, it's just incredible that, especially that that's a faith school, and it just feels a little bit like I get an email regularly telling me about what season it is in the church calendar and all those kind of things. And then actually all they really care about is that the kids follow rules. So coming back full circle into that conversation, the hierarchy, the expectation, the identity, the really knowing everything's transactional, it's absolutely correlation in an education space, right?
Completely. And one of the things I see is when things go well, the collective takes the credit. But when someone's burnt out or stressed, depressed, anxious, like then it's an individual issue that must be outsourced. Go sort yourself out and then come back in, right? And I see this across the education space and workplaces, right? Very culty, because it's basically saying if you are part of the tribe and you're doing exactly and behaving and producing in the way that we want in this exact way, then yay, we'll reward you, in different ways. But as soon as you feel the brunt of this system that is oppressive and is going to affect you, you are at fault. That, that's probably the biggest one that I see. And then the other one is we're mission driven, but that can be used against you. So this is the mission. This is the direction we're going. Vision, excitement, enthusiasm. We expect your enthusiasm to be like this all the time for this mission, but it's not your mission, right? And if you have a doubt, which can just simply be a question, right? Again, you are now seen as a problem that needs to be sorted out rather than a collaborator and an innovator. Like, every question matters so that we can do this better. Does that make sense? I see you nodding furiously. You're like, yeah, whoa.
Yeah, true.
Yeah.
As somebody who's been a part of the team, I'm still part of the team, obviously, I'm lucky enough to be the person who's classified to lead the team currently. But I've spent a lot of time trying to unpick why I felt some people, some of my previous leaders were stronger than others, what made me stay in education for such a long period of time, for those steps and everything else. And it's one of those things where you pin down and you try and think what was it and it goes back to that whole culture thing, doesn't it? That whole thing of feeling like you're part of a bigger picture thing. But then when you look at the shackles, when you stepped out, like I've stepped out of education and I still support education, so I have to be mindful of what I say, you know, otherwise I'll never get any more work ever again. but it's then looking at it and you're thinking, what does that exist? And I remember, and I always talk about this often, the way that I dressed in education. So for those people who really know me, know that I do wear socks around the house and I do wear socks to run. But I've never really worn socks with like jeans or with trousers. I wear a tuxedo and I don't wear them, and the board laugh at me on a regular basis. That's kind of, it's not my thing. That's what I've always, I don't know why I did it.
It is your thing.
But yeah, I'll own it then. That's my thing. I'm the guy who, yeah, but it's probably because I'm a PE teacher and I want to wear shorts, but they just won't let me. So I roll my trousers up and that displays that I'm not wearing full length trousers because they can see my ankles. But I remember going in and doing some work when I was still in education, and I went to work as a group grew into a, and took on some schools. I'd not been in that culture before in terms of what schools looked like, how you had to dress, and an appropriate mechanism of how you respond to leaders. And I was a head of department looking at leading the digital transformation across the whole of the group. And I rocked up in a T-shirt, some rolled up chinos, my trainers, and I was being expected to present. And I remember walking in, and I've never seen so many suits. Not even Marks and Spencer's or Mossbro have that many suits. I've never seen that many suits in my life. And people said, are you here for the right meeting? I don't think you're wearing, do you not wearing a shirt? And I said, my response is always to try and be funny. I know I'm not funny, but I always try. And I just said, I didn't realize it was fancy dress. And bear in mind, some of those people were much higher in the structure than I was. It was a mission deemed to failure. And I remember going out of the meeting, and my boss at the time, probably one of the most influential people in terms of my leadership style at the time, it was Jeannie Rogers. And she said to me, how do you think it went, mate? And I went, fucking awful, Jeannie. I said, I made a joke, they didn't like it. And I said, and also I said, I was like, did you not tell them that I'm here for my ideas, not what I look like? And she's like, you have to just bear in mind you're stepping into a different arena. And I went, I don't think I can play that game. I said, I don't think I really want to play that game. I said, they either want me to support them or they don't. Obviously, you're here. I don't want to annoy you and upset you because I have so much respect for you and I love you. But at the same point, I don't think I'm comfortable in that environment if I have to wear a suit to be listened to. And I just don't get it. I still see it at these events. And I'm just like, I wore a shirt, really, apart from a formal gathering, and I try and avoid those for such a long period of time. Like, what's going on? I don't know why they think that's a structure. I don't understand it. What's going on? Why does a tie and the structures, and why can't I tell a joke of this? I'm a CEO. If somebody laughed at me, I'd find it funny. And I still do. But I just don't know why education and corporates and many organizations, maybe the banking sector might be similar. I didn't feel safe. And this is a big lead into. I didn't feel safe in that environment because I felt I was judged, not for my ideas, based on they were looking at me and the outward side facing of me and making a judgment on why I shouldn't be in the room rather than before I've even opened my mouth to listen to what I had to say. And I know that you've done quite a bit of work, and I know that there's a whole thing around psychological safety. So my long-winded waffle leads into that. So let's touch upon what that means and how that might be important to potentially transform education in terms of that structure and leadership.
Well, the first thing the thought that came to me was that often women and people from minority groups will dress the right way and yet still feel like that, right? So just from like a privileged perspective, that experience still like occurs, like, oh, you put on the mask and you put on the thing and you still have to kind of prove that you belong rather than just it's a given that you belong. So it's unfortunate because we miss out on innovation, we miss out on connection, we miss out on really knowing each other, because when we can feel seen, heard, and valued, that's really the basis of psychological safety, right? So and that means going beyond just the mask and the version that needs to fit into that world, but actually seeing the human. Amy Edmondson's book, The Fearless Organization, I'd highly recommend if you want to think about psychological safety in a deeper way. And it's interesting because we'll do training and talks in different departments of a big organization, for example. And so you might get all the managers together and be like, do you think your organization is psychologically safe? Give them a little kind of insight into what that looks like. And of course, you can have one organization with different pockets of psychological safety levels, right? And it's not about whether the manager or the leader thinks they are psychologically safe. Psychological safety is measured as a felt experience. So do the people around you feel that that's actually the case? And of course, it can fluctuate, right? Depending on if we continue to build trust, are vulnerable, are open, that sort of thing. And lots of people think that you're just on a baseline of psychological safety, just like in the middle, and that there's opportunities to build it, but they don't realize that you can also erode it, right? You can go minus 100, right? By not handling a situation, a crisis. I've seen this in how companies handled COVID-19, coming back to the offices, mandating office time. Like, you know, there's companies that just didn't handle it well, eroded psychological safety, right? It didn't just stay at a baseline. It's much simpler than we think. It's simple, but not easy, right? To actually build it. And it takes a little bit of reflection and space to check in. That's the one component that I see missing in a lot of organizations right now. Cause it's like, we don't even say, how are you? I'm fine anymore. We say, how are you? I'm busy. How are you? I'm busy. That's like the way that you kind of interact now. Really busy. Like, life's really stressful. Life's really busy, right? And so it's this kind of space where we're all in survival mode, hustle, hustle, hustle culture, right? We're digital distraction. We're not necessarily more efficient. Let me say that out loud, right? Meeting culture is not helping us be more efficient. If anything,
preach that. Preach that.
Right? Meeting culture. Yeah. And so trust is built in small, tiny ways. Yes, it can be the big policy or the big thing that helps to, you know, whatever, create networks or places where people can be themselves. But it's really the tiny interactions that make the biggest difference in stack over time, because I don't care how many networks you have. If they don't know how to talk to each other, you're just creating more silos that are not actually all impacting the culture. Like, you know, I talk about creating a mentally healthy culture, and all of those networks and groups should be on the same side. And yet they're competing for budget. They're competing for space. They think their network's more important than the other one. And I'm like, what is happening? And it's the survival piece that makes us want to grab onto our tribe in order to survive, right? Because back in the primal day, if you didn't have your tribe, you literally would die, right? And so that's where people erode their own values, don't say the thing that they actually think, feel gaslit and kind of think, oh, maybe I shouldn't even think that thing, right? And this is where we get those pockets of toxicity.
And that's, it's everywhere. That kind of permeates every organization. If it's not intentional in the culture. And I know that one of the things that I learned from Steve over the years, and Steve is the most self-deprecating person I know, which I understand why he does it, and I've been in that world. But what he's done for literally hundreds and thousands of people in the sector, he's allowed them to be. Do you know what? If it don't work, it don't work. And every single time, and I say this not to blow smoke up him, but every single time somebody says, Steve, can you have you got anything that can help us out with this? Every single time he'll go, if I have, you can have it. If I haven't, I'll find somebody who has. And it's all, he's always been that open book. And I think that sometimes becomes the kind of that gets taken for granted. This is not like a let's thank Steve. This is his big red book day with Michael Aspel. This is your life. But I think interestingly,
those are the small examples. That's a beautiful way of going. That's how you build trust in those micro steps.
True, and I see somebody like Steve who I would say he's one of the most trustworthy people I know. Probably wouldn't call himself that, but he's the most trustworthy people I know because of that conversation. And that's a cultural thing. Steve makes that about that. What his priority is his family, that 100% full stop. Then it's doing a good job around his friends and the people he's connected to and work. And he can do all of those things. And then the podcast and then helping other people. And in all of that, does that very, very quietly. Interestingly, from a cultural perspective about creating these mentally healthy organizations and the thing that sits intentional in the culture, some of that has to be vocalized and give people the opportunity to be out, right? So I think a lot of the times that we say, this is our culture, okay? Mm-hmm. These are our vision and values. We believe it that much, we're going to spray paint it on a wall. And we don't really live that them culture and them values that we've put on the wall, but that's what we're going to say we are. And externally and almost to some levels and like on the surface, that's what it is. And then there's a whole underculture and a subculture. And I suppose, does that need to be, and maybe there's no right or wrong answer to this, does that need to be grassroots up, or does that need to be, does that need to permeate every layer, or does it need to be top down? How does it work to build a kind of successful organization that's got that strong culture?
In a perfect world, it's top down, but this is an imperfect world. And I think values need to be set, sure. But I think grassroots helps as well. So I think you can start grassroots and find your influencers at the top and help create change that way by asking for what you need. And, you know, sure, if you have the very, very senior person is a psychopath, which we do think there's high, amounts of, that's pretty tricky because you're always going to hit this wall, this kind of ceiling of like people that maybe are doing pockets of good work and maybe even connecting and creating little tribes within that. But you're not going to have the full scope of authenticity, both internally and then externally to clients, right? That's where the magic happens. Is like, if you can live this stuff externally as well as internally, then you're truly living your values, right? Which is tough to do. And it takes kind of discussion and space and modeling behavior. So I think leaders need to, as you described so beautifully with Steve, who we all love now. I don't know you, Steve, but your beard's great and you also are a great leader. That it's modeling the behaviors that makes most more difference than anything that's on your fucking wall. I don't care what's on your wall, right? Especially we're in a hybrid world. Half the people aren't seeing your wall, right? Or your policy up in the cloud, right? So it's kind of like simplifying it. And making it actionable. And when big global organizations, I talk about global strategy, so that needs to be culturally kind of sensitive and appropriate, but localized action planning. So that's the organizational responsibility, but then you're encouraging grassroots that are culturally appropriate in different places. Let's do everything, Ben. That's what I'm saying. All the things.
Yeah.
If you're the passionate person in the middle, you can make a difference is what I'm trying to say. Because everyone's like, complaining and in a cycle of like, oh, it's so toxic, or oh, so-and-so in this department is so difficult. And I'm like, that may be true. You have a choice to leave. And I know that's a privileged thing to say, but you have a choice to change something that's in your control, even if it takes 3 years or whatever it might be. But you also have a sphere of influence. Each of us has a sphere of influence with the people that we interact with. And I'd like to see more bravery in that way.
I agree. I think leadership at all levels is really important. That space to speak openly, not to be challenged, but that candor of, you know, don't make it about a person, make it about a process, or make it about something that you want to change. And I remember coming into the organization I'm in, and I said, I'm going to meet everybody for 30 minutes every month, and I'm just going to touch base. There's no target set. We just have a touch base, we fact find. And I said, it was after a couple of months, and I said, just tell me a bit about what I can start doing. What am I doing that really is pissing you off? What am I doing that is really shackling what you're trying to achieve, or anything else? And I remember the first one, and they went, not that there is anything. And I said, I think you're forgetting I know myself, and I know I'm a fucking nightmare. So you need to be open and honest about what's affecting you. And we sat there for a couple of minutes in silence, which Ben would have found really challenging, and probably so would I. But I did it, and I sat there and I thought, I'm just going to not speak until they started opening up and they said, there is one thing. I said, brilliant, what is it? They said, you keep saying this, but ultimately we don't have, that's not in a policy or a process. You keep saying that what you want to achieve, but actually we've not really put something in place that makes the team aspire to follow in those steps. And I was like, brilliant. I said, I can write that. I was like, it'd be easier now because obviously there's generative AI. But you know, back 3 years ago, it wasn't as easy. I had to write the process. But like, I want to be challenged. You know, the Matthew Syed kind of whole approach of rebel ideas. And ultimately, I want kind of like-minded wackos. You cluster together and collaborate with people that share the same beliefs and values, and you're kind of drawn to Kevin Sinfield thing of, you know, who was a great leader, talks about, you know, you're only as strong as the five people around you. But rebel ideas is all about actually diverse thinking. And ultimately, if I just bring in exactly the same people that just go, yeah, that's brilliant, that's a great idea, always done the same thing as me, I never get challenged, and no, neither does anybody else. What I want is people go, I think that's a little bit shit because of this. And I'm like, brilliant. You're not saying I'm shit. What you're saying is the bridge that I've built is going to fall down, and let's look at building a stronger bridge. Some of those bits. And I think leadership at all levels and creating a space where everybody can speak up, regardless what role they are. I was brought up by, and I'm going to try not to get upset because my dad's pretty ill at the minute, but I was brought up by this guy, Steve Hope Senior. What an inspiration that guy is to me, and still is. I just think, you know what? He created a culture in me and something in me and everybody around me where he talks about, regardless whether they're a cleaner, regardless of who they are, everybody has a voice and everybody's exactly the same people and just trying to get on. So don't ever speak to anybody. You speak to the waiter, you speak to everybody, regardless of whether they're owner or the person who's serving you, exactly the same. And don't ever forget that. And that's one thing that I'm really passionate about. If I ever saw that, and I have done, those people quickly become not my people, and I will tell them that I sit in that space and I think, you know what, don't ever do that. Or you can do it, but you don't, won't be around me. And I try and follow that. And I try and do it. I try and lead the way it is. I don't always get it perfect. Probably 99%. I absolutely fail and I'm an absolute shit. But ultimately, I think the team just respect that we're all just doing a job and just trying to get on out with. That psychological safety bit is so key. That mechanism, but not just saying it, as Ben said, putting it on a wall. I work from home. My Luke Combs pictures are going to be going up pretty soon. So that's what's going to be written on my wall. Hit me like a hurricane. they say nothing lasts forever. All of those kind of things.
I love Luke Combs.
Do you?
Yeah.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Yeah. Guys,
right, let's carry on with the podcast. Let's carry on with the podcast.
I'll leave the room if you want.
Let's carry on with the podcast. But ultimately, I can write it down. I can put it in a policy. But if I don't really push it forward and live and breathe it, it fails, because ultimately it's only something I've said and it's not something I've done.
And people forget that modeling behavior is also saying when you messed up, not just when you get it perfect. That's the difference.
Of course it is. Of course it is, because nobody gets it right. We're just all trying, aren't we? But I'm keen to think about that whole thing about yourself. That thing that I just openly talked about, you know, where I've got my learnings from, how I apply that, you know, some of the leaders I've been, and living every day as and trying to be just be the best dad, be the best person, be the best friend. I'm going to lead into the book. It begins with me. And it begins with you. So what? How does this transcend in terms of your learning, the journey that you've shared about earlier in the podcast, and now, what does that look like into the context of the book?
The thought crossing my mind is, Steve, as you're talking about your dad, and Ben, you're talking about your kids, is like kind of a sadness that I have not seen fathers role model very well, unfortunately, in my experience. And I just feel proud of you guys, and I don't know you really, but just to be stepping up in those ways, it shouldn't be seen as stepping up, if you know what I mean. It's just like being a dad and showing up, you know? So it's unfortunate that I haven't seen that many role models around that. The book is really, so when I was 13, I got my first library card. And for me, because we were sheltered, we watched Jesus videos and that was about it. And we'd studied the Bible and shit like that, right? But we weren't open to the entire, so this library card was the ticket to learning/education. And so as I read books and I read about, you know, people who were gay or people who were drug addicts or people who lived all these different lives, right? That was my kind of window into learning and into the world. So that's where I started, was like, I want to write a book. Like if there was one thing I wanted to do, it was to write a book. So to be able to work with a publisher and get this just kind of a year ago was pretty epic for me, including the launch, and it was pretty epic. So it's got my story in it. So it goes deeper into what were some of those dark points and what were the steps that I took to kind of move my life forward, because that's often what people ask me about, you know, because it's great to have the it was shit, now it's great. But it's like, what happens the day after you think about suicide, right? Like, how do you build from the day after you put the drink down and try and change your life and become a role model for your kids, right? Because I certainly wasn't when they were really young. So the book's got some of that. And then it's got stuff on groupthink. It's about internal activism. How do you create change in your part of the world? Thinking about your work. It's very hopeful. It's very uplifting. Like, I didn't want it to be like all the statistics for why everything's terrible, right? It's more about like, hey, if we're sitting in the room, if you picked up this book, you probably know some things are terrible, right? Whether it's internally, depression, anxiety, how you're experiencing life, or externally in your world. So I just really wanted to offer people tips and guidance on influencing your space, your world, but starting with you, because we can all sit around and blame everyone else, but we got to start somewhere.
I am a huge fan, just ordered. I'm in already, because I think... I've just been this morning. I've been in a conversation with a really good friend of mine. I say a really good friend. We haven't been friends that long, but interestingly, when you go back to somebody and have a conversation with them, you just kind of know that they're your kind of people. And we talked about all sorts of stuff, like some challenges that we've all had family wise, challenges that we're having work wise, da 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 da. And it was just really refreshing, and. After I talked about some of the bits of the things I'm on a big health kick at the moment and all the stuff that goes with that, he went, "Do you know what, mate? You've always got to look after yourself first." And I was like, "Wow, that doesn't sit well with me." From having come from a faith background, like a strong faith background as a kid, less so now, right? But the whole conversation is, you don't put yourself first. Everybody else comes first. Actually, you put a relationship with some kind of divine being first, then you put other people first, and then yourself, if there's anything left, right? He said, you need to put yourself first. Like, start, like, as in, you've got to, if you're not healthy, your mind, your head's not in the game, like, do that bit, and that'll allow you to be better at helping others. Because I am one of those people, and Steve will tell you this as well, like, I am one of those people who is always, like, trying to think, well, I can help fix that. I'll help you with that. If I can help you with that, if you need some money, if you need some this, you need to, and I get in trouble for it because sometimes it bites me on the ass. However, to see a book title that says "Begin with You" after you've just been in a conversation with somebody who says you need to, I thought this is powerful, right? And some of that comes across. I watched your TEDx talk, which has had 142,000 views on YouTube, which is pretty epic in and of itself. And in that conversation, same principles, right? It's that idea about how do you live a life that is something that the life you want and where it starts, and then moving it into into it's not just about you, but you've got to start there, right? How does that then translate itself into building the kind of life that you want? Because I'm thinking about this, that a lot of our listeners are frontline or are leading schools or in ed tech companies. They've got an opportunity to make a real difference with our young people. So what we've got to think about in that sense is, how do we kind of, what's a kind, it's not a magic formula, I know it's not, but how do we kind of move into that ways to live the life that you want after we've acknowledged that it begins with us?
Oh, I know we don't have much time, but you're making me think of so many things. One was, what I grew up religious, as you know, and we used to have a song that was "Jesus, then others, then you. What a wonderful way to spell joy." And that was like the vibe, brainwashing.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. Same one.
Wasn't it? Oh my God. Messed up. But at the same time, as a mother, like when people talk about the oxygen mask scenario and they're like, put it on yourself first. And then, you know, the vibe is like, leisurely help the old person or the child. The plane's fucking crashing, right? What's going to happen is you're likely to put both on at once when you're in a crisis, or it's not always going to be perfect. And I just want to say that, like, there's phases, like when I did my master's degree while studying full time and raising my two kids, I was not having bubble baths and meditating and, you know, self-care routines and lighting candles. I was not. I was investing in myself. That was the flip, right? I was tired. I wasn't going to the gym. It was not healthy or sustainable long-term, but it was the brave conversation that I needed to have for me, right? So that's, people think that it is bubble baths and self-care is the putting you first. It might be, but it might be having a difficult conversation, doing something brave, doing something out of your normal habits or routines to develop your neural pathways, those sorts of things. And I see the heightened depression and anxiety, you know, pandemic, you know, in the world today as people not living their version of their life. And it's younger and younger because kids are more and more influenced by everybody else's version of how they should be from social media, from their schools, from the education sector. So as teachers, educators, influencers, right? What are the things we can do? Lead by example. Talk about when you don't get it right as well as when you do, right? So in my team, we'd say like, how are you investing in yourself today? To be honest, totally messed up yesterday. You know, didn't go to the gym, didn't sleep well, right? That's fine. But then it's like, what's one small thing that you can do today? And so with kids, I mean, I just love teenagers. I love this phase of life where I've got young adults in my house, right? So much better than those tiny ones that you've got, Steve. because we critically assess and we debate, right? And so just creating space for them to be seen, heard, and valued is really what the bottom line is. And if somebody's depressed, I would want to inquire about what types of things do they think they're expected to do, but what's the little flame inside them that is what they really want to do? Who are you? Like, how do we open up people's souls? But many people in the education sector have put their own flame out for so long. The system's done it. I'm not saying it's their fault. They want to be mission-driven, but there's no fire left. How is that going to catch on our kids? It's not going to catch, right? We want the fire to spread, and the system contains it, right? So nurture your fire, I guess. And I could talk about this all day, obviously.
Yeah, and we're really grateful. We don't want to take much longer of your time, but we know that there's probably loads we could dig into that conversation. We always kind of finish our podcasts with like a quick fire round. So we've got three quick fire questions, and then we'll wrap up.
If that's right. These scare me the most. They scare me more than any conversation that you all have. This is going to be like things that everybody grew up with or something.
Okay. So the first question is the future of exams. So exams is a big topic for us. The future of exams, do you think they should be online, traditional, or scrapped?
Scrapped. Should I say more?
Nope.
Scrapped.
Let's go.
The key skill that will be needed, students will need in 2040.
I'm going to do empathy/communication.
Yeah. So empathetic communication, right?
That's it. Perfect. Yeah.
And then education in 50 years, what would your vision be?
Connection and collaboration. So we can learn by ourselves. There's books everywhere. I want us to learn to relate effectively as part of education, because that skill will help us as parents, in our marriages, in our workplaces. What is the group process that occurs and comes up, and how can people with differences come together and honestly discuss with that empathetic communication?
Love it. Well, it has been, we could dig into this, and I know that we probably, hopefully, we'll have another conversation, and I'm hoping this is just the start of a conversation going forward. Petra, it's been absolutely wonderful having this. I think there's been so much in it. Our listeners are going to get loads from it. So really appreciate your time today. The link for Petra's book is in the show notes. We'll also put the link to her TEDx talk in there, and to a website where you can find out a little bit more about the great work that that Petra's doing. Thanks so much for joining us on another episode of the Edge Futurist podcast. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Cheers, Petra.